So you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio.
I'm Don Heacock with the Division of Aquatic Resources, Department of Land and Natural Resources.
I'm here to announce our new interactive radio program entitled
Kauai Kai and Why.
Well, we'll talk about our island's freshwater and marine resources. We'll encourage listeners to call in and we'll take questions.
Ideally, to empower you to help us conserve and restore these important ecological and economic resources for the well-being of Kauai's watersheds. Our live Kauai Kai program will be on the first and third of
Fridays.
Each month. Aguiho malama kono.
Aloha, this is Adam Asquith.
This is Don Heacock.
And today we have a special guest in the studio with us, Auntie Linda Sproat, who will be sharing. She's a Kupuna and Kama'aina to the North Shore here, who will be sharing some of her family's history in Manawa about traditional Hawaiian resource management.
Today we're going to focus on food self-sufficiency and food security. And Auntie Linda will share with us many of her valuable memories about how she and her family, her ohana, gathered food, caught food, grew food, and how they viewed themselves as being self-sufficient and basically food independent.
And again, as a reminder of our new Kauai Kai and Why program is that we're not only bringing science to the listeners for discourse, but we believe that the foundation of education of managing our natural resources here on Kauai lie in the traditional Hawaiian values. So we want to educate you about those and hopefully change your behavior about how we manage those. And the foundation of that traditional Hawaiian management system was the ahupua concept and values like kuleana, taking responsibility for those resources. And in honor of Auntie Linda, whose family was a Konohiki fisheries family here on the North Shore, I'm going to read a brief introduction describing the concept of ahupua and konohiki fisheries that was put together by Kepa Mali. And it's traditional and historic rights to ocean resources and private properties in Hawaii. In pre-Western contact Hawaii, all aina, or land, and kai lawaia, fisheries, and natural resources extending from the mountaintops to the depths of the ocean were held in trust by the high chiefs, the mo'i, the ali'i'ai, moku. The right to use those lands, fisheries, and resources was given to the hoa'aina, the native tenants, at the prerogative of the ali'i and their representatives or land agents, often referred to as konohiki or haku'aina. Following a strict code of conduct which was based on ceremonial and ritual observations, the people of the land were generally able to collect all of the natural resources, including fish and other marine and aquatic resources, for their own sustenance, and with which to pay tribute to the class of chiefs who oversaw them. Shortly after the arrival of foreigners in the islands, the Western concept of private property rights began to infiltrate the Hawaiian system. While Kamehameha I, who secured rule over all the islands, granted perpetual interest in select lands and fisheries to some foreign residents, Kamehameha and his chiefs under him generally remained in control of all resources. Following the death of Kamehameha I in 1819, at the arrival of the Calvinist missionaries in 1820, the concepts of property rights began to evolve under Kamehameha II and his younger brother, who ruled Hawaii through the years in which private property rights, including those fisheries, were developed and codified. Interestingly, it was in these areas of fisheries, including the rights of the common people to catch fish, or the rights of the ali'i and konohiki classes to select a choice fish for their private use, that what might be termed fee simple property rights made its early headway into the native system. Kamehameha III formally defined the ancient fishing rights and practices of the Hawaiian people in the Constitution and the laws in 1839 and reconfirmed them in Hawaiian laws in 1842. So what we see is that even early in the creation of the Hawaiian kingdom, They incorporated the traditional Ahupua laws into kingdom law, and those later became adopted into state law, with the exception of Konohiki fishery. So we've talked a lot before about how preservation of water rights to taro has been preserved into the present. There are water rights to taro that cannot be taken away. On the flip side, we don't want to say private fisheries, but the kuleana fisheries, those fisheries that families and maka'ainana had the rights to, have been taken away, and it has opened up fisheries to the public, which has led to what's called the tragedy of the commons. Once you open up a resource for everybody, no one has responsibility for it. So what we'd like to do is have Auntie Linda share some of her family's history and remembrances of what those Konohiki responsibilities for fisheries resources were like. And we want to remind the listeners that it's such a tremendous privilege to have kupuna like Auntie Linda come and share with us, because they are the true repositories of the wisdom and knowledge that it's going to take for our grandchildren going forward. If we want to continue to live here in the islands, we must learn from the kupuna like Auntie. So thank you so much for joining us.
Mahalo. You're very welcome. Actually, it's my pleasure to be here and be able to share with you.
So your family is traditionally from Kalihiwai here on the North Shore.
Yes. My grandpa became a Konohiki fisherman in Kalihiwai, and he told us the story about how my great-grandmother, his mother, came from Haena, and her people came in 1200 A.D., on canoes from Tahiti and landed in Kalalau. And they lived there until the place became overpopulated and moved out to Haena. And my great-grandma's house was right on Limahuli Stream. We know where it was. And she thought she was really smart, because she got her husband and the other men of the family to route the stream through her kitchen so it would be easy for her to wash her dishes. And we still go down there till today. But Grandpa, when Grandma, great-grandma got married to this Chinese man in Kalihiwai, the family moved to Kalihiwai. And my grandpa decided that he wanted to be a Konohiki fisherman. So the whole family got together and spent many days going through all the process of it. And finally they decided that he could become a Konohiki fisherman, because his grandfather, whose name was Makali'i, had been a Konohiki fisherman before him. So he told us that one night, after they had many prayers and many meetings, he was told that tonight was the night that he could go down to the ocean and see if he was going to be accepted after the prayers. So he had with him a big laulau made of tea leaves, but he didn't know what was in it. And he had to walk on the Hanalei side of Kalihiwai all the way down to the ocean. And when he came to a certain rock, and that rock is still there in the ocean, right where we call the Moy Ditch, it's right there. And he had to go on that rock and stand there and wait. And when they wouldn't tell him what was coming to collect the package, the gift that he had. So he stood there, and all of a sudden a big shark came up onto the rock, and he was to throw the package to the shark. And if the shark accepted it and went back into the ocean and left him, he had been accepted as a Konohiki fisherman. And it indeed, that was what had happened. He threw his package, and then he had to walk home, he said, and it was so dark he couldn't see very well. He stumbled around the rocks, but he was very happy. He was about 12 years old at the time.
Wow, that's heavier than I thought we'd even get into, Auntie. That's amazing. And what's amazing is that not only can you trace your family's history from Tahiti to the canoes in Haina. So what that means is that you are Kama Aina to Kalihibai in a certain history, and so you had to ask permission to receive that responsibility for mm-hmm. for those resources.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
He had to do that, yeah. Anyway, and then he had the rights to a coulee in Kalihibai Bay, mullet in Kalihibai River, and then around the corner going toward the lighthouse, Kawapea. There are three beaches up at Kawapea. And he had the Moe Konohiki there, and further up around the past the lighthouse, where we call Makapili, he had bonefish, and they would have hukilaus, and my dad would stand on the top and kilo, and the people in the water looked like they were only about 1 inch tall. It was so high, you know, and you could just see their feet flashing in the water when they were kicking.
Just excuse me, Auntie, just for our listeners, the term that she used, kilo, was the man up on top with the flag directing the people in the canoes or to the direction of where the akuli or oio or whatever the fish was that they were targeting.
Thank you for reminding me. I forgot.
And so was this just your family that participated in those events?
No, we had other people who lived in the area, like the Pike family, Uncle James and Uncle Benny and Uncle Jack, who was a really fantastic diver. And they came and helped us. And most interesting, right around the corner at Hanapai, where the reef starts on the Hanalei side of Kalihibai Bay, there lived this fisherman whose name was Levi. And he was a really interesting man because he would come every morning and ask my grandma, "Auntie, what kind of fish you want to eat for dinner tonight?" And she would tell him. He would go home, and he had all these different kinds of wooden mallets made of different kinds of wood. And one was for each kind of fish that he had labeled. So he would get the mallet that she would requested, what kind of fish went with that mallet. He would get in his canoe and paddle out. And at a certain, he would make some food for the fish. He would paddle out, bang the mallet against his canoe, and that kind of fish would come. And he had a small, what we call an opai net now, a small scoop net. And he would scoop up just enough for the family and put it in his canoe and go back to the shore and then bring it to Grandma.
Wow. You know, we've talked about that before, and what you've described are two very different traditional Hawaiian fishing responsibilities. One of the akule, we need to remind the listeners, akule are small, big-eyed scad, so they're about the size of your hand or two hands, right? Mm-hmm.
14 inches.
14 inches. And these live in big schools, and they move in and out of the bays, right?
So it's That's right.
In big schools. And so mm-hmm. we had somebody in your family who was responsible for spotting those when they came in, right? And so somebody had to be in charge of that occasional resource that came into the bay, right?
Right.
Whereas your neighbor, Mr. Levy, mm-hmm. right? He had his spot on the reef. That was his spot, right? Mm. And he was taking care of those fish, and he had them trained.
I never thought about that. Yeah,
yeah. He had them trained to mm-hmm. those different mallets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because they made different sounds.
They made different sounds. And anybody who's kept fish in an aquarium or a tank can observe the same thing. When you feed them and you ring a bell or walk up.
Yeah. My brother did that when we started some kind of a fish. I forget what it was. It started on Maui when we had the prawns. We started Macabrechian, whatever
right,
it was.
Right, Malaysian prawns,
yeah.
Yes.
Many years ago.
You know, I think it's important, the akule to Native Hawaiians is like salmon to Pacific Northwest Native Americans. It was the fish that really fed everyone.
Everybody. Yes.
And it was shared with everyone. There's many, many people today, Auntie, that are afraid that if we go back to these sustainable, community-based subsistence fisheries, that they'll lose their ability to fish, or that they I think they forget the protocol, that if they came out and helped pull the nets, mm-hmm. you would automatically share the catch with them. It's cultural.
That's
it's
right.
traditional.
Yes, it is.
So can you explain kind of the whole, so how would you lay the nets? Did you guys have okay. boats? And, I mean, how big were the nets? Were they 10 feet long or?
Okay. Let's start long time ago.
Yeah.
When we had small boats, and my grandpa and my dad would sit on the hill right where we live today.
Which is
the relocation center for tsunami victims on the Kalihivai side of the.
Yeah, you know, in fact, let's back up a second even before. So at that time, your family lived in Kalihivai Bay down
right
at the beach.
Yes, yep. at the beach.
At the beach.
And they would walk across the valley and go up the hill and sit there. And they made a little, a lean-to so that they would be in the shade under mm-hmm. the trees. And they would study all these different fishes that would come in. And the biggest schools would be a coolie. And they could tell what kind of fish it was by the color and the behavior of the fish. And they would watch it and study it. And they could even tell you what size net you needed. The size of the eye, you know. If it was big, then you needed a two-inch eye or something to catch it. So they would study it. And they would watch it, and when it got in a good place, and Hawaiians were very, very particular. They gave everything a name, even in the ocean. We have rocks, one called Makapu'u and one called something else. So when you looked for fish, you had to be careful because sometimes, depending on the time of the year, different kind of seaweed would be growing on the rock, and you could mistake it. For a school of fish, because we have done that before, and surrounded a big rock.
With lots of limo on it.
With lots of limo on it, you know. Anyway, so they would study it, and when it got to a good place, which was usually a sandy bottom, so it wouldn't tear the nets, the boat would come out of the river, we'd load the boat, and it would come out of the river, and most of those nets were between 35 and 50 feet deep.
Deep?
Yeah. And if it was, we were going to surround on the inside, we had 12-foot kind and, depth.
Right.
But mainly those were used for the rivers.
Oh.
We have a net now that's 3/4 of a mile long.
Wow.
And every foot we have a 1 pound lead that we put on the net. And it was my sincere desire to be able to drop that net. And one day I got to.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but we don't use it anymore because it is illegal now to use.
Because of the size of the net? Is that, or the eye? Or?
No, mainly because they feel that it's so big. Mm. And they had some tragedies on Oahu before.
Right.
Somebody drowned in the net and so forth like that. So we have it packed away in a big wooden box up on,
wow.
on the shelf. But most of the fish nets were, depending on, you know, you'd get it, the depth of the water there. And then we dropped, surround the, first you had a man on the hill with a red flag directing everybody which way to go, left, right, drop the net. When they put the thing down, pull up the net. And they would, after the net was completely surrounded, they would close it up. And it depended on the size of the school of fish. If it was something that could be handled in one day, say 500 pounds, 2,000 pounds, then we would attach wings on the back of it, another piece of net, and you would pull it. And that was why it was called a huki lau. Because in the old days, they didn't have nets. They only had tea leaves, dried tea leaves. Huki means to pull, and lau is the leaf. So they only used the leaves, and it would frighten the fish and make them get closer to the shore. And then they would put a regular net around it.
Yeah, they didn't have the big nets like you had to catch the school in deeper water.
Yes.
Right.
And then you'd pull it up, and we had a special agreement with Kilauea Sugar, where if we had a hukilau in Kalihiwai or at Kawapea or at Kahili, they would blow the whistle in a certain pattern. And all the people who were not working on that shift would rush down to help. And for everybody who helped, they got a share of the fish. And it was called a mahele. And that's how they got to eat that fish. Then we would call the markets in Kapa'a, and they came with what they called their fish boxes. It was a pickup truck, and in the back they had a little box with screens and stuff. And then we would weigh it in the basket with a bamboo, you know, the old-fashioned way. We didn't have fancy scales and so forth. And they'd pour it in their fish boxes and put ice on it and go back to their place.
Wow.
To their markets, yeah.
I think one thing that's really important about all this is all of that effort and the fishing was done to feed the people of Kauai and basically your community on the North Shore.
Sure. All the people who came to help, see, they all got some of that fish. And especially in the summertime when the weather was warm, they loved to dry it. And they would dry it on the beach at Kalihiwai. They'd just take their pile, go down to the ocean, clean their fish, and get two bamboos and put it up, and put a string and sew the fish through the eyes and hang them there. And near the ocean, there were not very many flies. So they wouldn't get on the fish, and the fish would get dry and hot from the reflection of the sun on the white sand. Mm-hmm. And it was marvelous.
So your mahele was that you shared the part of the catch with the people who came down to help pull.
Yes.
Then you sold some to the market so right. Other people on Kauai could
have
partake.
Some. Yeah.
And you got to pay your property taxes or whatever. and then so you kept some and then you dried them for
yeah,
your own use.
And the people who came could dry them too.
Also, I get it.
Everybody
was drying their fish.
Would dry their fish. And yeah. Some days there would be many pools up there, you know, with fish, especially the smaller ones, all hanging down. Then they'd bring their bowl of poi and sit down and take them off.
Making me hungry, Lynn.
So, and is that how you usually ate your fish? Dried?
We had it dried. We had it cooked. You know, yeah. It depended on how the schedule was.
Right.
Like if we had a big school and we had to be working until almost dark, usually the grandmas went home and cleaned the fish and cooked it. So when we came home, we had something to eat. But otherwise...
Was there any trading of akuli for kalo, for taro?
There was some trading for taro, for other kinds of fish that we didn't have at the time. Most people had bananas, but other kinds of things. Like I remember up in Kilauea, on the way going down to Kahili, there was a little... banana field in there where an old man lived, and he cut the banana trees and used the whatever you get out of it, the sap or whatever, and he'd put it in bottles and he'd sell it to people to dye their nets. And it was called shibu. And what happened was sometimes we'd go up there and there was a stream in there too, so he could, you know, clean his fish and everything else. And then he said he liked to get, after he took the sap from the banana trees, he would wrap the fish in the banana stumps and then make a fire and put it in there and cook it that way. And then it would taste like banana or, you know.
I've never heard of that. That's great. So he would slice the banana stump and put the fish inside and close it and steam them like in the banana stump.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
It was really interesting. Yeah.
So how did you guys, so your tutu would cook it at home? You guys had...
We fried it mainly.
You fried them.
Or
yeah.
broiled,
yeah.
you know. Just threw it on the fire and broiled it
yeah.
and ate it with poi, yeah.
Wow. So did you guys have Lo'i? Did you have taro patches
in In the old days, if you had a piece of property down near the ocean, you also had one up by the waterfall. So our taro was up by the waterfall. Then eventually, when my dad got older and got married, they traded the Mauka land for a piece of property down by the ocean so that he could be, we could be right next to my grandpa and grandma.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
Yeah. And that land is still up there. It's called Haile. That's the name of the place. And it's very wet up there. And I understand some people have bought that land and are trying to sell it for house lots. But, the stream comes right by there, so I have no idea how they would.
They don't want to grow taro?
That would be a good thing. Taro is in big demand now.
Huge. Indeed it is, yeah. And that's what we're trying to get at, is when change people's behavior about even how they view property. What's the best and highest use of that property?
Right.
If we know that was taro land because it's well-watered, our grandchildren will benefit more if that's maintained as or restored to taro than a house.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
And you get all the other environmental services of those taro lo'i, those pond fields.
Right,
function as flood detentions, basins, sediment detention basins. Plus they provide incredible habitat for endangered water birds. They do all of that.
Oh, yeah, and they get lots of shrimp and stuff, you know?
That's right.
That's right.
So you talked about the fisheries also, or your family's kuleana for those fisheries extended over to Kalihikai and Anini?
Over at Kalihikai, we were the only family in the state that had octopus konohiki. And it ran from, I can't even remember the name of the beach, the one with the little pond, from there down to the end where the Carter was his name. He was the manager of a sugar plantation on the other side where the Carters lived.
This is at Kalihikai.
Kalihikai.
I know the little pond you're talking about.
Yeah. From there to the end was our he'i konohiki. And we would catch our he'i there. And it was usually a winter activity because they all came in during the winter. And my grandpa and my dad never speared them. They were really terrific. They had a canoe, and they used hokimo sticks. You know what hokimo is?
Hokimo.
It has a round nut like this, and they have leaves about this thing. And when you soak them in the salt water, they become very sturdy. And they used a lot of the hokimo wood for stuff that they needed to use in the ocean. Anyway, I think their sticks were about 15, 20 feet long. And they would stand in the canoe, one in the front and one in the back. And I'd be sitting on the bottom of the canoe with water sloshing around. And they'd pole the canoes over the reef. Then they would if they saw a he'e, a squid, they would tickle it with their long stick. Then the he'e would crawl on the stick, and they'd put it over the canoe and just run their hand down the stick, and it would fall in the canoe. Of course, I was sitting in the canoe too, so I would not want them to crawl on me, but you get used to it pretty quick. And that's how they caught it. And they could see for long distances, you know.
What would they do with all those he'e, those octopus, Linda?
Okay, usually we ate some. We gave some to people who wanted, ordered some in Kilauea. We'd send some to the market. And then we had a really neat way of saving it. We made a box out of wood. And it was pretty big. I think it was 5 by 8. On the bottom, they put chicken wire. And the sides were all wood. And the top was wood too. And they made a handle on it so that you could open the top or hinges and look inside. But the reason they put the chicken wire in the bottom was that they would put the leftover squid in the box. And we just had a hook and eye, you know, to close it. and they would float it in the water, in the shallow water, so that the octopus could stick his tentacles down and feed himself so they wouldn't get thin. And when we'd get orders from the market, the best one was there. It's Kauai Marine now, I think, in Kapa'a.
In Kapa'a, yeah.
It was Urabi store. I remember right. Mr. Urabi when I was
on
little.
On Ulu Street, yes.
Yes. Anyway, they would always be calling for octopus. So we'd go down and open the box and get out whatever we needed and take it down to the store that wanted the octopus. Well, one day, we had quite a bit in there. We get down there and we open the box. My grandpa and my dad open the box and there's nothing in there. So my grandpa gets very upset and he says, I know just the thing to do. And there is a spot on the reef, and I can't remember where that spot is. I sure wish I knew. Where we would catch eels, and we would, there's a special way that you caught them. Anyway, so, and we have one eel called the Kauwila. And a Kauwila, I believe the English name is dragon moray. It goes around on the top of the water like this, and it can stand up straight. And one day, many years before, my grandpa was squidding before we had the konohiki, and this big Kauwila came and bit his hand, his left hand, I guess it was, and wrapped his tail around a big piece of coral and dragged him into the water, trying to drown him. So there were two old Hawaiian ladies down, further down, catching squid too. So he was waving and yelling, and they came, and they beat on the Kauwila. And we learned when we were little, you always beat on the tail of a eel, because that's where the nerve endings are, and they become sedated, I guess you call them. You know, they're more relaxed. Anyway, they beat on him, and Grandpa's fingers were like this, those three fingers on the left hand.
Couldn't open them.
Couldn't open them because the Kauwila had bitten him. So he got a Kauwila and put it in the box.
In the squid box.
In the squid box. And we went back a week later, and we drove down to Kalihikai. That's what bugs me. The name of that place is Kalihikai, which means the edge of the ocean. I'll tell you the story about Wanini later. Anyway, when he opened the box, there was nothing in there. When we were driving down, there was a man who lived across, a Hawaiian man who lived across the road. And he was sitting on his porch, and his arm was all bandaged up. So my grandpa said to him in Hawaiian, I see the Kauwila got you. And he didn't say a word. He just sat there, and that was all. Dad and Grandpa chuckled, and then they knew. That was the end of this. That's funny.
That's a great story. You know, we're going to, on that, we're going to take a short break and then come back, and hopefully Auntie will share some more with us. Thank you. We'll be right back.
Sweet lay, oh, ina ole. ever fading bloom.
This is Adam Asquith.
This is Don Heacock.
And in the studio, we have a very special guest, Auntie Linda Sproat, one of our cherished kapuna, who's we're so fortunate that she's been willing to come in and share her manao, her family's manao, who were, had the Konihiki fisheries responsibility for Kalihi Bay and other areas on the north shore here. And she's telling us just some fantastic stories and reminding us all of how fortunate we are to live here and what a great responsibility it is, and hopefully teaching us how we can change our behavior to live more sustainably here. Auntie just told us a great story about octopus fisheries at Kalihi Kai, and reminding us that, and she has been using some place names that some of them I haven't heard. And she, it's a bit of a pet peeve for her that we don't use more of these and understand the history. And you wanted to share a story about that area at Anini, yeah?
Right. Okay. When I was little, we lived in Kalihi Bay Valley. And in the evening after dinner, the family would walk up the hill towards Hanalei, right where and sit on the hill and sing songs and all kinds of stuff. And right where the intersection is that goes down to what everyone calls Anini today, there was a sign with King Kamehameha there, and the name said Wanini. And one day we went up, and some boys who had been hunting shot the W off the sign. There was a big hole in it, and it was hanging, and I was very upset. So the next day, after school, I cut a piece of cardboard with a black crayon, and I wrote a W, and when we went up that evening, I taped it to the sign. Well, with all the rain and everything, it fell down, and it became Anini. So I had my mom help me call people who I could report it to, and nothing got done. So finally, I said to my grandpa, "Where did the name Wanini come from?" And he told me that Wanini is the edge, the end of the road before it goes up to Princeville, where you cross the stream. That stream is Wanini Stream. And the reason it's called Wanini is because it's very shallow, only about an inch or two, as it spills over the sand to go into the ocean. If you stand right there where it's spilling over the sand, you will feel bubbling water under your feet. You can feel it bubbling. And Wanini means that, a spring bubbling under the sand. Wow. And so I questioned that and questioned that. And now the whole place, even the park, is called Anini Park. And it's not Anini, it's Kalihi Kai.
It's that trend, unfortunately, has happened in many places. Even Hule'ia was once Hula'ia. And there's many cases. And I think of that Olelo No'iau, in the language there is life and in the language there is death. If we forget the names of these places, they may be lost forever. Mm-hmm. And so we really can't let that happen. I hope not.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, and I think it demonstrates how important it is for us to seek out kapuna like yourself and hear these stories and maybe make changes in the way we speak, right? So so and start trying to use the correct term for that area. Start trying to look at our resources differently, as you and your kapuna did, and think about how to teach our children the traditional values and ways of doing things here. And, you know, that's a good segue into a question I had with regard to the name of Banini Stream, because what we know from Kepa Mali's interviews with Kupuna from all over the island and the early accounts, and let me go back to reminding folks that that in 1848 was the Mihaly when they began created private land ownership, and at that time the Makaainana, the people, came forward and testified as to what areas they had responsibility for. And today, most of those that came down were either lo'i, kalalo'i, or house sites. Mm-hmm. But those were the only ones that were granted. They were claiming all the resources that they needed, and many of those were fisheries also, as your kupuna did. Mm-hmm. But the most frequent fisheries resource that was claimed as a kuleana were o'opu in the freshwater streams. And you had mentioned earlier about some of your family's responsibilities for o'opu in Kalihiwai.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and o'opu is a freshwater fish we have here in Hawaii. It was a major fisheries for Native Hawaiians.
Right. And it was a majorly good fish to eat.
Yes. Especially the o'opu nakea. Yeah.
Yes. And we used to make lavalu out of it.
Lavalu.
Yeah, and what a lavalu is like a laulau, only you wrap the fish in the tea leaf and you steam it, or we used to just put it over a fire, you know, and keep turning it. And the o'opu nakea was wonderful. When I was little, they would come down twice. First the males, about the end of August, and then September the females would come down, and the males were much bigger and darker than the female ones. The female ones were more brownish and very pretty, the designs on their body. And we would catch them, and the kids from school would take off school and come up and dive, and we would hook them. The old way of fishing it was fishing for o'opu was using a kahi. And a kahi is, I guess you call it, a stationary structure to divert the water through the bamboo that they used.
It's like a grate.
Yes.
Screen or a grate.
It's a sluice gate.
A sluice, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, and then the good thing about it was that you could make it so you could put the bamboos far enough apart so that the small ones could get through.
Right.
With a net, you catch everything, you know, the small ones, and they drown a lot of times. So that's the good thing. But it was very hard work because you had to divert the stream and move the boulders in the stream. And after, when it was over, my dad and my grandpa and my dad's brothers would always try to put the boulders back so that it would go back into its regular bed and wouldn't disrupt, you know, if they had a flood,
right,
disrupt the taro lo'is around there and so forth.
So you had a certain place in Kalihiwai Stream that you would go to periodically to make this kahi?
Yeah, once a year.
Once a year.
And it was very far up in the mountains, past... If you go over the Kalihiwai Bridge now and look Mauka, you see the waterfall.
Yeah.
It's a couple miles past that waterfall. Because
wow.
When we'd get the waterfall, we'd say, whoo, we're almost there.
Home.
Yeah. But it's further than that.
So you must have, you walked up and camped, is that?
We walked up and we would camp, right. And the nice thing was when the kahi was done, we could camp on the kahi because it ran at an angle above the water, so that you were off the water and you didn't have to be in the bushes with all, you know, the dampness and the mosquitoes and everything else.
So you would collect the opu, and then how did you get them back? Did you clean them there?
No, we put them in bags and we floated them down. We all walked in the water and floated them down. Yeah.
Auntie Linda, it's... Adam just asking that question tells me that he's never caught o'opu nakea, because you know in a wet gunny sack how long they will stay alive.
Alive, yeah.
Long time. You could ride a bicycle from Hanalei to Waimea. And the other thing that's so intriguing about the kahi or ha, I've heard them called both terms, these sluice gates that were built by Native Hawaiians to catch o'opu during their downstream run, their spawning runs. The big males do come down first. They're very large and almost black, or dark blue. But you're the first one I've ever heard, Linda, that said that by spacing those apart, you'd let all the little ones go to catch just what you needed, the larger fish. And it's Jackie Hashimoto, Uncle Jackie, who's no longer with us, but we miss dearly, told me a lot about O'opunakea. And actually, all the scientific tagging we did in Waineha with Randy Hee, who was a big help to us when he was with McBride Sugar, just really documented what you already knew. Science just was there documenting what traditional knowledge had been recording for 1,000 years. That fish is, just for listeners that don't know what the O'opunakea is, it's a native goby, freshwater fish, but its larvae go out into the ocean and return to the streams, a stream, probably not the same stream they hatched, but that fish was so important to traditional Hawaiians that it had a god even named after it. It was probably one of the best eating fish I've ever eaten. And I'm sure you would agree, Linda, it's something that we need to conserve and restore. Many of their populations are depleted almost everywhere.
Now, did you harvest the Hinana, the returning?
We didn't so much on this side of the island, but in the Waimea side. Right. And my mother was from Waimea, so we would get Hinana from there. And we were lucky if we had a little bit for one meal, and that was what we would get.
So the Hinana are the juveniles of O'opu returning from the ocean, moving upstream to live as adults.
And they
re-entered the stream sometimes, some places, in such numbers you could harvest these very, very, very tiny fish.
Mary Poena Pukui described them entering the mouth of Waimea River in, this was probably June, early summer, maybe April or May, when they're migrating upstream. These are post-larval. They're almost translucent. You can see right through them. And they're only about 3/4 of an inch long. It said that the Hawaiian men were catching so many of them, it took 8 or more men to carry the net. These are fish that weigh 2 milligrams. I mean, they weigh almost nothing. And to carry that many, O'opunakea must have been so abundant at one time, and they were. But their populations are dramatically reduced today.
Now, let me ask you something for our listeners. And again, we're trying to educate people and change our behavior about how we view the resources and view sustainable living on Kauai. So here's your family, live in Mon, the beach, eating fish and poi. If somebody were to do that today, live under a blue tarp on the beach, you know, we would consider them homeless and poor. How did you consider yourself growing up? What did you got? I mean,
I didn't consider myself poor. I thought, well, when we were growing up, like when I got to the 6th grade, I was going to Kamehameha next year. And I had to earn money because, you know, I was going to be a boarder. I needed clothes. I needed shoes. You know, Kilauea school, you could go without shoes and all this other
the
stuff.
The good old days.
Yeah, the good old days. And so I earned my money from picking opihis and cleaning them and hooking, what you call it, o'opus and selling them. And that's how I earned, you know. Like my dad and my grandpa always told us, there are many things around that you can use to further your income or to get things you need if you just use your head.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just for food. You were managing and harvesting those resources to earn some money to go to school.
Yeah.
Wow. And so what? So you're living down there. So what was a typical meal when you were a child? Do you remember? That your grandpa, let's say, what would he eat?
Okay, grandpa would love his fish and his poi. We had a lot of fish and poi, but my father was Chinese, so they had a lot of Chinese food, you know.
Well, were they growing rice in Kalihibai too?
No, well, when I was older, the goose used to grow rice, and we'd have to go in the chase bird house and chase the birds and all this other stuff. We wouldn't go and help them. But we had a mixture of foods, not only Hawaiian food, but we had, because there was Chinese in our family, we had Chinese food too a lot of times. But we had a lot of poi, a lot of lavalu, you know, with fish and that kind of stuff. And of course, we all enjoyed dried squid and all this other stuff, you know.
And a garden? Did you guys have a garden?
We've had a garden, and we planted our own, you know, vegetables. Mm-hmm. We had vegetables and fruit, mangoes, and all kinds of, you know. And we learned to do a lot of stuff with those fruit that we could pick, like mangoes and guavas. Many people wouldn't realize, but we used to make guava ketchup, and it tastes like ketchup. It is delicious.
How did you make that?
Just like that. You get the guavas, and you cut them, and you take the seeds out, and you cut them up, and you boil it, and you mix it with different seasonings. You pour it in your ketchup bottle, and nobody knows the difference.
That's great.
Yeah.
So now that was in the days of Kilauea sugar, so they had in Kilauea, they had, you know, stores up there. So you could still go up and they had canned foods or sugar or whatever.
Yeah.
So you still...
We could still, yeah.
Yeah.
Go shopping.
Go shopping, yeah.
Mainly Hanalei and Kilauea, like Maliong store was right by the river over there.
Right.
And they delivered. So you could call up and order stuff and they'd bring it to your house.
No way.
Oh. You didn't have to... We didn't go to Hanalei, yeah, the Maliong store. They delivered it to our house. And later on, Nakamura store in Kapa'a. They had meat, they had all kinds of stuff. And we'd call up, and any car coming this way, they'd throw it on the car and they'd drop it off at our house. Hey,
why don't we do that now? Instead of thousands of cars driving to... That's amazing.
I have no idea.
Community-supported agriculture actually started a long, long time ago. It's nothing new.
Yeah.
Wow.
Auntie, where did your drinking water come from? Where did you get your water?
Okay, our water came from a stream, and actually we had a puka in the rock that it came out. And our dentist kept telling us all the kids from Kalihiwai had marvelous teeth because of the water that we drank. And we didn't realize that at the time.
It was probably spring water.
It was spring,
coming right out of a crack in the rock.
And then we'd climb up the hill, and there was a water tank up there on the hillside. And every summer, it was the kids' big thing to climb up there because there was a purple lilikoi vine that grew up there, the only purple lilikoi. And all the kids would take our bags and go up there and harvest lilikoi and drink water.
So did you boil the water? That was just spring water,
just spring water.
Wow. And you used that water for bathing, or you just bathed in the mulibai in the?
Most of the time we bathed with the same water, you know, we had to have hot water, right? We had those old diesel heaters,
right?
So you had diesel heaters to create your hot water.
Yeah.
Not fire. So is that what you cook with, too? Did you have diesel heaters?
No, we had gas stoves.
Gas stoves.
Yeah, because I remember our gas stove, when the first tsunami hit in 1946, we had a kukui, which is a Hawaiian gas kerosene lamp, on the kitchen table. And my father had put some water on to make coffee or tea or something. And when the wave hit, it took our house up the valley. And when we found our house, the gas stove was still going and the kukui was still going.
Wow.
Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, that's a great story that many of our listeners might not have heard of, the history of the tsunamis and the movement of families like yours that lived in Kali'i mm-hmm. Wai, moved up to other places. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, when I was little, we had 3 stores and 2 gas stations in Kali'i Wai. And we had a Chinese market that made ice cream and other kind of Chinese goodies like meonapua and, you know, with, what do you call it, the dough outside with the meat inside.
Manapua?
Yeah. Anyway, they did all that kind of stuff. And then they moved away. The Mitsui store is the one in Kilauea now. And then one went to Hanalei Kunyuki store. And the other one didn't. But anyway, the stores moved too.
Yeah, so most people don't realize that there was a whole community in Kali'i Wai at that time. That's mm-hmm. where people lived near the water, right?
Right.
It was the plantations that created communities like Kilauea.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that trend was all over the island. Niumalu, Nauliuli once had lots of people, and no one lived in Lihue. Lihue didn't really exist till recently.
Well, I just want, this has just been so fantastic, and we thank you so much for sharing. And if there's any other, Manao you would like to share with the listeners before we have to pass the baton in a little bit. But
I can't think of anything.
We're just so fortunate that you're willing to share your family's history. It's just incredibly valuable. Thank you so much. And Don and I are going to try to continue
Mahalo,
this
Linda.
And find other kupuna like yourself who are willing to share with us.
And I, if you would like, maybe I can help you find some too.
That would be great.
We would love that. Yeah. In closing, I'm going to read something from Ke Pa Mali's treatise on kupuna fisheries and what he says about them. Perhaps the most fragile and precious source of information available to us, and the one that's most often overlooked, particularly in academic settings, are our elders, kupuna, those who stand at the source of knowledge and life's experience, and kama aina, who are knowledgeable about the tangible and intangible facets of the aina, the kai, the vai, the leva, and the resources and history therein. For the most part, the paper trail, the archival documentary records can always be located and reviewed, but the voices of our elders, those who have lived through the histories that so many of us seek to understand, are silenced with their passing. So thank you so much for sharing.
You're welcome. That was fun.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you. Aloha.
Aloha.
Aloha no.
And on what we share today, and still I am recalling all the things we do not say. But in my heart, I recognize.